Let's depart from reality for a moment and talk about the Wizard of Oz. It's been suggested by many of people that part of the allure of the story of Dorothy was that she just wanted to go home to the farm. In the nearly 40 years between the time L. Frank Baum wrote the book, The Wizard of Oz, and Hollywood made it a movie, a huge chunk of the American population left the farm. We have become a much more urban than rural culture, and that means people living in rural areas can get lonely. Rural isolation has a number of negative effects on the people who experience it. Our next guest studies the situation and recently co-published research in the Journal of Rural Health. Carrie Henning-Smith, the assistant professor in the Division of Health Policy and Management at the University of Minnesota and the deputy director of the University of Minnesota's Rural Health Research Center, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Carrie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
It's easy to get shocked by some of the numbers, starting with the shift in the American population. We used to be country people. Now we're largely city people.
Yeah, this has been a major change in the way that our country looks in a relatively short period of time.
And it is continued over the course of the 20th century. So the numbers are pretty much the opposite of what they were, it seems like, 100 years ago.
Yeah, we have essentially done a complete flip of where we used to be. It used to be more common to live in rural areas, and now we have, depending on how you count it, anywhere between 15 and 20% of people living in rural areas and everyone else in cities.
Wow. So that's which makes parts of the rural parts of the country even lonelier than they once were, it would seem.
It definitely changes the way that we interact with one another, and it also radically shifts the resources and the allocation of resources for rural populations, and that has implications for things like loneliness and all sorts of other issues.
When you say allocation of resources, what do you mean?
I mean that we tend to divide up resources, financial and otherwise, certainly health resources, by where the population is concentrated. It's logistically really challenging to spread resources across populations that are thin and live far from one another, and there are just fewer people there to get resources in the first place.
Okay, so this actually kind of gets me in the mood of talking about this year's census, but that's a different thing altogether. But the point is that we do allocate resources based on where people live.
Absolutely, yes. It's the way that we divvy up political districts and decide who represents who and how many people are showing up for certain places in Congress and elsewhere. And it's also the way that we divvy up financial resources at the federal and state level.
Talk about the scope of the work that you do with the Rural Health Research Center. What's the center all about?
Sure. We do work that's mostly funded by the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, and we cover a wide range of topics. We've done a lot of work on access to health care, particularly access to obstetric care, which is a real issue in rural areas. We do a lot of work on quality of health care. And then in my own work, I do a lot of work on aging and long-term care in rural communities, on the well-being of informal family caregivers in rural communities. And then my favorite topics to study are those that we're talking about today, where I look at mental well-being and quality of life in rural communities, everything from mental health and access to mental health care to suicide, suicide prevention, and loneliness and social isolation and the way that we connect with one another.
Let me bring in the aging part of that for just a second here, because I'm curious to know if the rural population does tend to skew a bit older.
It does. On average, rural populations are older than urban populations, and there are a variety of reasons for that. For one, rural older adults have tended to stay in rural places, where we've seen some younger adults move out of rural places and into cities, in part because that's where centers of commerce and business and education tend to be concentrated. And so for economic reasons and otherwise, rural younger adults have moved out. And that leaves rural places older than urban areas.
Now, Carrie, if you would, talk about the scope of the recent study on rural isolation that was published in the Journal of Rural Health. What did you go looking for?
We went looking to see whether there was a difference between rural and urban older adults. We used a survey that only looked at people who are 65 and older. And we looked to see whether there was a difference in their social isolation, and this is an objective measure of how many people do you have in your life? Do you have friends and family members who you can count on? There are a number of questions that folks are asked to try and measure social isolation. And then we also look to see whether there are differences in loneliness. And this is a subjective measure where people are asked about whether their perceived need for social connection is being met.
Interesting. And so this is, you didn't have any particular measures of loneliness. It was just if they said they were lonely, that was good enough?
We did have measures of loneliness. And in fact, in the survey, we don't, I didn't conduct the survey. I was using data that had been conducted or collected by others. But the survey itself uses questions that don't specifically ask someone if they're lonely. There's a lot of stigma attached to that term. We know from research that most people, almost everyone, will experience loneliness at some point in their life, and some people experience it frequently, and yet we aren't very good about talking about it, and people, if asked whether or not they're lonely, are somewhat reticent to say yes to that question because there's a stigma to that. And so instead, we use data that use a validated measure asking people whether or not they feel left out sometimes, always, often, whether they feel like they lack companionship. And so a few questions like that that get at the issue of loneliness, but without using the word lonely directly.
That's interesting. It's got that much of a stigma to it.
It does. It does. It's just not something that we are comfortable admitting to, despite the fact that it tends to be part of the human experience.
Carrie Henning-Smith is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the Deputy Director of the University of Minnesota Rural Health Research Center. We're talking about measures of isolation and the effects on health of seniors in the countryside. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, perhaps with your own story to tell. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So with the data you had, you were able to essentially do side-by-side comparisons, age 65 and up, of city and country?
Yes, I was. And then I also want to say on top of that, we did some work looking just within rural places and talking with key informant experts, people who study this topic or think about this topic or work on this topic in their daily lives. And we asked them, what are some of the rural specific issues related to social isolation and loneliness for people of all age groups, including older adults? But with the data that I was talking about just a minute ago, we were able to do a side-by-side comparison of rural and urban older adults.
Let me back up a step and ask how you define rural areas, because, for example, we have, you know, this is generally considered a rural region that we broadcast to, basically from Eugene, Oregon, down to Mendocino, California. So wide expanses of open land, but also a bunch of little cities where people do live closer together. I'm just curious, for example, in our region, how we define rural versus urban.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's something that we could spend hours talking about, how to define rural. It's a big question here. But we define rural on the county level, so whether or not your county is designated by federal designation as metropolitan, and those are counties that have a city in them with more than 50,000 people, or whether your county is designated as non-metropolitan or rural, and those are counties that can have small towns or even small cities, up to 50,000 people, but most of those counties have many fewer people than that, and some have only a couple thousand people or only a few hundred people. So there's a wide variation in what's considered rural.
Okay, so on that basis, for example, Jackson County, which has a city of bigger than 50,000 people, does have a statistical, metropolitan statistical area. So that probably would not be considered rural. Josephine County, right next door with Grants Pass, no bigger than about 25,000, would be more likely to be rural.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So let me talk about just the general findings. Was there any single finding in what you were able to do in the country versus city people that rose above the rest in significance to your eyes?
Yeah, there are two, and I think they go hand in hand. And the reason that I talked earlier about the way that we look at social isolation as this objective measure of whether or not you have people in your life, and loneliness as a subjective measure about whether or not your needs are being met, is really important for looking at these two findings side by side. So we found that rural older adults have more people in their lives and they experience less social isolation. They report having not only bigger families, which we know and sort of fits with our stereotype of rural families, but also more friends and more friends who they can count on. So we see that rural older adults have more robust social networks than urban older adults. We didn't necessarily expect to find that when we set out on this research. But despite finding that, we also found that rural older adults were more likely to report feeling lonely. It wasn't a dramatic difference between rural and urban older adults, but on average, rural older adults were more likely to feel as though their social needs were not being met. And this tells us a couple of things. It tells us, for one, it's really important to look at multiple measures of isolation and loneliness to get the full picture. And for another, it's not enough to know that someone has someone in their life, but we need to go further than that. And in rural places, sometimes more work is required to ensure that people are able to connect with one another. There are barriers around transportation, access to internet, access to places to gather and be together. And so someone may have a lot of people in their lives, but we still need to go the extra step to ensure that they're having meaningful connections with those people.
Interesting. So you asked about basically the people available to them, and in rural areas they report large groups of people, but they don't necessarily see those people that often.
That's right.
And how profound can the isolation be? What kinds of gaps in time were you finding where people didn't actually see other people, talk to other people face-to-face?
This goes with what other research has found too, but it, to my mind, we found pretty profound gaps in the sorts of social isolation and loneliness that people were reporting. And this is true across the board for rural and urban older adults. But we found that just about a quarter of older adults in all areas, rural and urban, were saying that they only socialized with other people up to several times a year. And not a small, not an insignificant percentage of those folks said they see people only once a year or less than once a year, that they're getting together with people to socialize. On the flip side of that, we saw that more than half of older adults in both rural and urban areas were socializing with people at least once a week, which is great. So there are plenty of people who are finding ways to get their social needs met, but we have a long way to go to ensure that everyone is having access to those same connections.
It sounds like then what you're finding, the issue is not so much the distance and where you live as the age. It sounds like over the age of 65, you're more likely then to be isolated.
Well, the data that we used here only looked at older adults, mm-hmm. but there have been other studies looking at the rates of loneliness and isolation across the population, so not drilling into rural and urban, but just across the population. And those studies are striking. They're finding some of the highest rates of loneliness and isolation among younger adults, and some troubling findings around middle-aged adults. Older adults are important to study on their own for this topic because there are unique things that happen at the end or toward the end of life and later life, major life transitions around retirement, sometimes loss of a spouse, loss of a partner, loss of friends. Older age can, it doesn't need to, but it can come with changes in your independence and your health status. And all of those have really profound implications for social isolation. But we're seeing really troubling things for younger adults, too, when it comes to how they're connecting with one another and whether or not they're getting their social needs met.
Which brings up the question about whether socializing is described as just in person. I mean, people do connect each other electronically all the time, but does that come even close to fulfilling that psychic need that people have for other people?
that's our million-dollar question right now, and there are people trying to figure out the answer to that. The results that we have so far show a really, really mixed bag. They show that interacting, especially on social media, can have positive benefits for people, particularly if you're interacting with people for the purpose of then getting together in person later. So maybe you use social media to organize some sort of group event, and then you all get together in person. That can have really positive effects. Social media can also be helpful, especially for people in rural areas, if you are a member of a very isolated group. So say perhaps you have a rare disease and no one living near you has been diagnosed with that. Social media can be a really powerful way to connect with someone else across the country or around the globe who is living that same experience and to know that you're not alone. And so we know there can be really good things about social media, but we also know that there can be some really, really detrimental things about social media. For one thing, it's really disruptive to the way that we connect with each other in person to have these devices in front of our face or between us and someone else. We're seeing this all the time, and we're seeing it really cause some damage to the way that people interact with one another in person. We also know that people, and particularly young people, are experiencing really negative things online, things like bullying and being targeted by people who feel as though they have a little more autonomy and a little more anonymity to say what they think and to say really cruel and hurtful things in a way that I don't think people would always say in person. So I think the online question is a huge one. We can't talk about this topic without talking about it, but I think it's a real double-edged sword, and we need to do a lot more to make sure that it's not replacing our in-person interactions with one another.
We're talking about people here on the Jefferson Exchange, specifically people living in rural areas largely and largely over the age of 65. Carrie Henning-Smith is the Deputy Director of the University of Minnesota Rural Health Research Center, so she studies a lot of this. You can join us on the exchange with your questions and comments at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what are some of the health effects you notice from people who are greatly isolated?
They are enormous. There's a relatively recent study that came out showing that the health effects of being isolated and lonely are similar to those of living with obesity or smoking 15 or more cigarettes a day.
Wow.
They have the same, being isolated or being lonely gives you the same risk of dying, of mortality, as smoking or obesity. And I work in public health, and in public health, we have spent a lot of time and energy focusing on how to help people maintain a healthy body weight and focusing on helping people quit smoking. I don't think we've spent nearly enough time thinking about how to help people meet their basic social needs. There are other health effects beyond mortality. We know that being socially isolated and lonely is associated with decreased immune system functioning. It's associated with poorer sleep, with poorer cognitive functioning, a whole host of issues, health issues that we don't want to see bubble up in the population, and we want to help people prevent.
Well, but given, as you pointed out, that there's a stigma attached to talking about loneliness, and you know, you prefer to people have prefer to be called left out, or you know, that they lack companionship, or some other euphemism. I mean, so it's obvious you can't just say, "Hey, you're probably lonely. Here are some services." So how do you get people engaged in programs that can help break the isolation and improve their overall health?
I think we need to do it without labeling programs as programs for people who are lonely.
Like the anti-lonely initiative, you probably wouldn't do very well, yeah.
Probably not. Although in the United Kingdom, they've had this campaign to end loneliness. They appointed a minister of loneliness there. And so they're confronting it a little bit more head on. But I'm not sure that would really resonate with everyone here in the United States, and I think we need to find ways to excite people and put a positive spin on it. So instead of saying, here's an event for people who are lonely, say, here is an event to connect with your neighbors, or come together and volunteer on this initiative, do something with some sense of purpose with one another, be in social relationship with one another. I think that's going to be much more appealing to people than the idea of just only targeting people who are lonely. And then I think it's also really important that we normalize this. If we start to talk about loneliness as some sort of pathology,
like it's a disease, yeah.
Then I think that's only going to increase the stigma. The reality is, I think you would be hard pressed to find anyone who hasn't experienced feelings of loneliness at some point in their life. It's how we're hardwired to live as humans. We're social beings. And our body is conditioned to recognize when its social needs are not being met. So I've heard others equate loneliness with hunger and thirst. And I really like that analogy. We certainly wouldn't stigmatize someone for feeling hungry and thirsty. We would help them find a drink. We would help them find food. And so a feeling of loneliness is really the same. It's just an internal signal that you're body and your mind are not getting the sort of connection that you need to thrive. And so I think we need to find a way to normalize it, to recognize that it's just a healthy, positive sign to have your body pointing that out to you. And then we need to find ways to connect with one another.
Just a couple seconds left. Any recommendations of people who are hearing this and thinking, you know, I could stand to be around other people? Good first steps?
Sure. There's some research out there that I really love that shows that all of us tend to be a little bit nervous about reaching out and making that first initial ask of other people. Do you want to get together? Or even smiling at a stranger. And yet, almost all of us are really receptive to getting those asks. And so I think if you're able, just put yourself out there and ask. And consider that you might be helping to meet the social needs of the people you're reaching out to. I think we all have something we can contribute here.
Right, so they might need it as much as you do. Carrie Henning-Smith is the Deputy Director of the University of Minnesota Rural Health Research Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.